Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Most Americans say, if asked, that we'll have a woman as president in their lifetime. Washington Post White House correspondent Anne Kornblut is not so sure. She covered Hillary Clinton's campaign, followed Sarah Palin's, sees the political culture in Washington and around the country now, and she's skeptical. It may still be harder than most people think, she writes in a new book, to break what Hillary Clinton called the highest, hardest glass ceiling. This hour, On Point, women and American political power. You're welcome to join us. What do you think? Will you see a woman in the White House, in the Oval Office? Anne Kornblut joins me now from Washington. Her new book, and it is terrific, is Notes from the Cracked Ceiling, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and What It Will Take for a Woman to Win. Anne, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you. Happy New Year.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, and Happy New Year to you, too.
It's great to have you. I thought I knew all about this, and yet I dipped into your book and realized I didn't. I didn't know just what all had gone on in those two campaigns, Clinton and Palin. I didn't know about a lot of the other women politicians you write about in this book and nearly the detail that you present them. And I wouldn't necessarily have known from our conversations over the years, Anne, in your time now at the White House, that you would come down in the pessimist camp when it comes to women and American political power, women and the presidency. Why do you?
Well, I'll say it was a surprise even to me when I first started taking a look at this issue, sort of late in the campaign, frankly, after mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton had dropped out and Sarah Palin came along. I really started to think that maybe, you know, we joke in journalism that three is a trend,
sure.
But I started thinking late in the campaign that perhaps two was a trend when I saw what both of them, the way they ran their campaigns and some of the hurdles they both hit and the problems they both had. Ultimately, when I went back to write the book and interviewed a lot of people, both from those campaigns and also outside those campaigns, women who've run for office elsewhere, it occurred to me that a lot of the women have run into obstacles, even though they'd been told they could be anything, that the country is ready, that they themselves weren't necessarily ready to talk about gender, that no woman candidate had really figured out the language to use to both appeal to women, not scare off men, not scare off women, to bring voters in both genders together and use it as an asset, that no one had really cracked that code. And that on top of that, there were still all of the biases that people, I think are out there, and some of them are worse than people even expected. So when I drew all of those threads together, I really concluded that it's going to take something even more extraordinary, an even more extraordinary candidate than Hillary Clinton, who had every advantage in the world, to actually win someday.
So you triangulate off of Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton. You make a triangle out of that somehow. There's a lot more in here as well, and say it's going to be tougher, maybe not in the lifetime of Americans who are covered in these polls, but, you know, the lifetime of people asked right now is a long time. It's most of this century for some of the younger people who are asked there. I mean, is it as rough and difficult and forbidding as that?
Well, I call myself a skeptic rather than mm-hmm. just a pessimist. Mm-hmm. I interviewed Rahm Emanuel, the White House chief of staff, who's obviously been in politics a long time, knows a lot about the candidates on the ground because he, of course, was out there recruiting House members just a couple of years ago. And his answer to me when I put that very same question to him was, look, we never saw Barack Obama coming. Well, when I then asked him to name a few women who might be in the pipeline, who might win sometime soon, when you get down to the nuts and bolts of who it might be, he, like many people I spoke to, was stumped and didn't really have a list of names. So I do think it's possible. I just don't think it's as inevitable as I think people thought it was. And certainly when Hillary Clinton was on the horizon, everybody just took it for granted. Oh, yes, a woman can win. A woman will win. A woman basically has won already. And I think my hope with this book was to puncture some of that assumption and to point out that it's actually not inevitable. And that's why it hasn't happened yet.
Oh, maybe one of the reasons in Hillary Clinton's case you suggest is that in some sense, they didn't run her as a woman. You quote one of her advisors saying it was as though his boss were running with a penis.
And your words.
You can, you can imagine the look on my face when I had someone say that to me on the campaign
What did that
trail.
Mean exactly, though?
Well, they were proud of the fact that she was running as the tough candidate. And there were certain points in the campaign, I'm sure you remember them well, where she was seen as the tougher of the two between her and Obama, or in fact, the toughest of all the Democrats up on stage. And there was even some polling at a certain point very early on when voters were asked who they saw as the toughest, where Hillary was seen that way and Rudy Giuliani was not. Mayor of 9/11. Mm. So they believed, and with very good reason, that voters viewed women as not as tough as men, and that that was a shortcoming they were going to have to overcome. And they did. But many people, even within the campaign, believed that by the end of the race, they had overcompensated too far, and that she had failed, like many women for her, to walk this very fine balancing line between being woman, being human enough, and being tough enough for people to see her as an executive. It's been a line that almost no woman has been able to straddle.
Looking back on her posture around the way she presented herself as a woman in the campaign, maybe I had never read about it or maybe hadn't focused, but your dissection of this December 2006 way back memo from Mark Penn, pollster who was right at the heart of the Clinton campaign, was really illuminating to me. What remind us what he said in that memo. This is a private internal memo there.
He mapped out, Mark Penn did a lot of research, and he's taken a lot of heat, I should say, up front for not having run the campaign correctly. But I think early on, he made a lot of assessments that any campaign strategist running a woman for president, running Hillary Clinton for president, would have made, which is he looked at the country and he said, look, people are ready for a woman president. Women will rally to her. He was looking primarily at the general election and saying, here are some things we need to do. We need to look at the example of Margaret Thatcher in Great Britain, who ran, of course, she was the Iron Lady of British politics, and see that people can envision their commander-in-chief as somebody who's tough, who can lead the military, who can be tough on national security, who can be kind of a single mother, a single first parent, a tough, loving mother in charge of the country. That doesn't have to be a father the way we've always seen it throughout history. He made a lot of assumptions, many of them about the general election, because I think the campaign underestimated the ability of Barack Obama to come in and win the nomination.
But if I may read just a little bit from what you quote here, Mark Penn wrote, this is for the Clinton campaign. So early on, he wrote, in analyzing the situation, regardless of the sex of the candidates, most voters in essence see the president as the father of the country. They do not want someone who would be the first mama, he writes here. But he goes on to write, they are open to the first father being a woman. And the Clinton campaign ran with that.
That's very true. They assumed from the outset that being a mother, being maternal, would equal being weak or not being a commander-in-chief. So they didn't take that. And as I write in the book, that contrasts with some other women in politics, namely Nancy Pelosi, who has used her maternal persona as part of how she's run as Speaker and been the Speaker. But the Clinton campaign said that's not a winning formula.
Sat with her gavel as Speaker of the House and grandchildren all around her.
Precisely. But the Clinton campaign said, you know what? There's a reason this has never been done before. We're not going to try that now.
And then there was Sarah Palin, who was manifestly a mother of many children, and that was all around her as she ran.
A completely different model of female leadership, of course, and one that has, I should say, changed even over the short time that she's been on the national scene. But I think will be an interesting model going forward because there are so many younger women in politics who then have young children at their peril. I think we saw with Palin the real danger of emphasizing motherhood and that it is not only a distraction, but that to some voters, almost a disqualification.
You quote Kira Samamatsu at Rutgers Center for American Women in Politics, a kind of big hub of research on this subject, who says straight up, I'm pessimistic, very pessimistic there will be a woman president in my lifetime, frankly. But you also remind us that there's a whole generation out there, a younger generation, who's just absolutely assuming it will happen.
Well, that's true. The young college-aged women who I spoke to and who were interviewed by many reporters throughout the campaign broke evenly between Obama and Clinton, and in some very important places, namely Iowa, actually went to Obama overwhelmingly. And when you talk to them, there was one young woman at Wellesley, which of course was Clinton's alma mater, who said, she was quoted during the campaign as saying, this will happen in my lifetime. There will be another woman who comes along. It was not seen as being something difficult. And frankly, that's a testament to the world that all of us were raised in, told that we could be anything we wanted to be. But I think without some of the reminders that some challenges still remain, and this is one of them.
And you bring us that moment where Geraldine Ferraro talks to one of her own daughters. Of course, this was the vice presidential candidate in the 80s. About who had just cast her vote that day and not for the woman. And the former Geraldine Ferraro just lost it with her own daughter, kind of with her daughter's generation.
She did. And I have to say, when I called Geraldine Ferraro to interview her for the book, I almost fell out of my chair. I couldn't believe that her own daughter hadn't. And she, I must say, had really good spirits about it in hindsight. I talked to her sometime later.
This is her daughter who voted for Barack Obama rather than Hillary Clinton.
She talked to her daughter on Super Tuesday, and Geraldine Ferraro's daughter very sheepishly told her mother that she had voted for Obama. And Geraldine Ferraro went crazy, in her own words, and was furious with her, but recognized that this was a phenomenon that was happening all over the country, that there were younger women who didn't feel the tug of history, or if they did, it wasn't powerful enough to make them vote for Clinton, that there wasn't a kind of automatic gush of support from the sisterhood, and that was perhaps both a failing of the Clinton campaign to tap into them, but also something that was going on in the culture where that was not something happening in this generation.
Anne Kornblut is with us. She covers the White House for The Washington Post. She spent 2.5 years covering the Clinton campaign, traveled with Sarah Palin after her nomination. She's out with a big new book called Notes from the Cracked Ceiling, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and What It Would Take for a Woman to Win. Really interesting perspective. Not a slam dunk yet, anyway. Why is the share of women in office in America still so low? What's the hang up? What's the problem? Will we ever have a 50-50 Congress? When will we have a female president? And stand by. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about women and political power in America and when their day will finally really fully come. Anne Kornblut is my guest. She is White House correspondent for The Washington Post, covered the campaigns of 08 of Clinton, Palin. She's out with a new book called Notes from the Cracked Ceiling. You can join the conversation. Do you assume we'll have a woman as president in your lifetime? What will it take to make that happen? And what should we learn from the Clinton and Palin stories? And we've got a couple of old pros in this arena who've been good enough to join us this hour to look at this question. First from New York, Kellyanne Conway joins us, Republican pollster, president and CEO of the Polling Company, co-author of What Women Really Want. Kellyanne Conway, it's good to talk with you again. Thanks for being here.
Same here, Tom. And it's always a pleasure to be on with Ann and Celinda. Happy New Year.
Yeah, as Celinda, as in Celinda Lake, who joins us from Washington, Democratic pollster, strategist, president of Lake Research Associates. She is co-author across party lines here with Kellyanne Conway of What Women Really Want, How American Women Are Quietly Erasing Political, Racial, Class, and Religious Lines to Change the Way We Live. No less than that. Celinda, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So Anne's book is just coming out. She's looked back at the Clinton and Palin campaigns and said she's not so sure Americans are right to assume necessarily that they'll have a woman president in their lifetimes. In fact, she sees a kind of a maybe plateau in the push of women into politics and power. Celinda, first to you, how do you see that?
Well, I think Anne has a very good point in her book, and one of the biggest problems we have is I don't think we'll get a woman president until we get more women into the pipeline, and one of the things I'm sure Anne's discussing in her book is how the pipeline has kind of leveled off. We need more women governors. We need more women committee chairs. We need more women who will look from these positions of power. Now, one of the interesting developments is the number of women running from a corporate base, and that's particularly true in California right now with both Meg Whitman and Carly Fiorina, and that may be a new avenue to get more women into the pipeline. But the bottom line is until we have more women, and it's not just the exceptional woman of Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton, but that people can name a number of women that they think would be capable of being president. We're going to have a hard time getting our first woman president.
Kellyanne Conway, you know, we look around at this country, you've got more women than ever in college, dominating college entrance now. Women, you know, just law schools full of women, women going into all kinds of careers. If that's the case, why does it appear to be hard to fill the political pipeline Celinda describes, and so does Anne?
Tom, sadly, for a few reasons. First, many women still look at politics as a dirty word rather than as a means to the ends that they really care about. I mean, if a woman says, oh, I hate politics, I can't stand politics, we have to convince them that they really don't mean that, because if you say I hate politics, effectively, you're saying I don't care what happens with health care reform, or it doesn't matter to me who runs the local tax and regulation structure, even though I want to start or continue my own small business, or education's not a main concern to me. We know that none of those are true among women, but we have to allow them to see that politics is the means towards these public policy ends. Secondly, I think seeing is the first step toward believing, and unfortunately, some of the most recent examples of women in politics and women being treated as women in politics at the highest echelon in the names of Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin not so long ago have been very negative. It's been a negative experience for many women, particularly these young women, who look at those examples and say, gee, do I really want to cash in these law degrees or entrepreneurial spirits or business degrees or medical degrees, as you point out, for a life of being picked on? And I think that the way that Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton were treated, often by female journalists, may I note, Anne would be the exception perhaps, and there are others, but often by female journalists last time around, the way they were treated, the focus on husbands and hairdos and haute couture, would probably be very disconcerting to many women who would look at it as a step backward in their careers.
Anne Kornblut, how about it? Everybody knows politics ain't beanbag. It's rough. What did you find in your reporting? Did they really get treated worse, in a sharper, harder, even crueler way?
You know, it's funny. As a card-carrying member of the mainstream media, I went through the campaign very skeptical of the claim from first the Clinton campaign, then the Palin campaign, that somehow we were being tougher on them. When I got home, I got off the campaign bus. I went back and watched a lot of television, a lot of YouTube clips from the campaign, and looked at a lot of press, a lot of clippings, and did come to the conclusion that actually it was a lot harsher than I had realized, and that Kellyanne is right. A lot of it did come from women, and that there wasn't anyone sort of calling the critics when they crossed a certain line. A lot of it was on television. And when I interviewed, I went to interview Anne Lewis at the end of the campaign, who's been around a very long time. And she said, in her view, journalism was the only career where having more women in their ranks hadn't actually made a difference in the way that women were treated. She was very upset with the way Clinton was treated. So I chronicle in the book not even a full accounting of some of the things that were said about the two of them, but things that when I went back and looked at them shocked me. I had not realized, for example, that a portrait of Sarah Palin naked had been painted by a bar owner in Chicago and hung in his bar and then written about in the Chicago Tribune as a feature, as kind of a light, happy feature, with anyone saying, hey, is this how we want to treat our vice presidential candidates, or even questioning it. Certainly, for in the case of Hillary Clinton, a lot that was said about her. When you add it all together, the questions about whether the country is ready to watch a woman grow old, for example, mm-hmm. pictures of bags under her eyes. One commentator saying, for example, that she reminded him of his ex-wife outside court. A lot of things that are not funny, that we sort of laughed at, and people said, well, can't you have a sense of humor? But when you take them all together, really aren't funny, and you can see why the campaigns felt like they were so under siege.
Celinda, do you see that changing, or is that barrage going to be waiting for any candidate? Was that especially for Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin, or is that what all women candidates have to face? Is that a permanent impediment to, you know, the full pipeline you spoke of?
Well, I think it's a very strong impediment, and until we have some kind of accountability, and I think the accountability on the press is actually diminished rather than increased, I think we're likely to see it. And it's really another thing I would add to Ann's statement is both Ann Lewis's and Ann Kornbluth's that it's amazing what is legitimate to say about women that would not, for example, be legitimate to say about an African-American candidate. You could not cover race in the same way and go out of bounds in the same way and not have immediate responses. And we really don't have accountability. The women's organizations aren't strong enough to do it. We don't have self-policing within the press. We don't have a societal norm that says that women really rise up and say this is just an illegitimate way to cover any professional woman in any setting. And so until you get that accountability, I think it will continue. And I think given the power of the blogs, the alternative media, et cetera, there's actually less of that accountability than there used to be. So I think we're into that for quite some time, and I think it is a major impediment because even if women are willing to put themselves through it, they don't want to put their families through it. They don't want to see their sons and daughters see that kind of coverage. And politics in general has gotten a lot tougher on the families, and I think that's an impediment for both men and women, but women in particular, to running for office.
Let's hear from some of our listeners. Bowling Green, Kentucky. Martha, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. I think both Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin, simply, I observed that in conversation, the tone of their voice and their body language, they would build up, be defensive in their response. And I think that invited vulnerability, a lack of confidence. And I just think that's the key right there. I will see, I'm in my early 60s, and I do believe that if I'm fortunate enough to live into my 80s, I will see a woman president. But I don't know where that comes from. Possibly it's just our mothers passing that down to us to be that defensive. Men don't do that. I don't know how, but that's it right there. It's that defensive tone in their voice. And when I heard it, I went, okay, you're out.
And what, maybe it's justified by the kind of barbs that they take, Martha. Maybe they're coming for a tougher treatment than men, or do you not buy that?
I think that possibly so, yes. I think it's just going to be a generation of changing attitudes. I think the young politicians, women politicians coming up are going to observe that. I think their mothers are going to pass that attitude of yourself onto these women, and then they're going to be able to say what they mean but not taking it personal.
Yeah.
That's what I observed of these women. I observed Hillary Clinton. Oh, gosh, I'm going to say too much. But anyway, if you look at her body language, conversation, and even her dress from the time I've observed her in politics, it changes not to her own personal style, but to what she expects people to how she wants people to perceive her to get ahead.
Of course,
that was my observation.
Martha, we've got it. Of course, it would hardly be the first politician to have some of that going on. Kellyanne, I want to bring that to you. But Ann, first to you on this issue of tone and body language, Martha found these two candidates defensive often. What do you? And here's a female American voter who, found the females defensive, and she checked right out, she says. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say two things. I would say one is that Martha is right that politics is performance. And however unfairly we might think that we're judging some of the female candidates, the trick is the onus is going to be on a future female candidate to figure out a delivery style that appeals to both men and women. What I heard from some advisors as I was doing my reporting for the book is that they counsel their clients to lower the tone of their voice some, maybe not to be as present in their ads, to adopt a style that voters don't find as grating because, like it or not, voters found women to be not as fun to listen to as some men. And that was just a cold political reality, whether it was fair or not. The second thing I would say is, and it's interesting that Martha was the one making this call, is that women voters can be every bit as tough as men voters on female candidates. In fact, sometimes they hold them to a slightly higher standard. And I know that both Celinda and Kellyanne can talk about this, but mm-hmm. women want to understand how they can relate to a woman who's running for office. Hey, if she can have a job and a family, well, I don't know. I can't do that quite so easily. How can she do that? Mm-hmm. In focus groups, they look at their clothing and their hair and they say, I wouldn't do it quite that way. So it's going to be very tricky for the woman who runs and is successful to figure out how to thread that needle.
Kellyanne, how do you hear it when you hear an American voter, female, looking at two women who are out there, you know, making their shot at it, and she finds them defensive? Does that mean women candidates have a more headwind with women, perhaps, than men?
I think that is partly true. You know, generically, it's rarely true, Tom, meaning if you ask the question, if all you mm-hmm. knew about one candidate was he was a man and she was a woman, the other was a woman, for whom would you vote? The respective genders still give a slight preference to their own gender. Men tend to say, I would go for the male candidate. Women tend to say, I would go for the female candidate. But the number one volunteered response, usually a plurality in our polling, has been the volunteered, it depends, I need to know more. And that's fair. People need to know what are your politics, what are your positions on the issues, your experience, your political pedigree, and the like. But at the same time, the reason that people prefer their genders is because it sounds good on paper. What happened to Senator Clinton and Governor Palin is that the question never remains, would you vote for a woman, but would you vote for that woman or this woman?
Mm-hmm.
And the same for Barack Obama. It's just not generically, would you vote for the first black president, mm-hmm. but would you vote for this man for president? And to his credit, he had the luxury of not running as he never once, as I recall, stood up and said, I'm running to be the first African-American president of the United States. Many others said it on his behalf and about him. He never really said that. He was running to be the 44th president of the United States. And I don't think the women who were running for president and vice president, respectively, had the same luxury. Their gender was much more intertwined with what they were expected to say and how they were expected to act. I will say this, though. Mrs. Clinton, as I saw it as First Lady, had to put herself in what I refer to as the campaign uniform when running for United States Senate in 2000. She was a sitting First Lady. She was in New York running for United States Senate, and she changed her hairdo and her look because she had come on an assault of criticism, unfair criticism. When she was First Lady, we all remember the famous pink suit press conference. If her husband had been giving the same press conference, nobody would have commented on the color of his clothing, let alone his clothing. And the pink suit press conference, she was always changing the style of her hair, and she came in under criticism. So when she ran for Senate, she basically put herself in a navy or a black pantsuit, the same hairstyle that she pretty much retains to this day, almost 10 years later. And she never deviated. Why? In my view, to win back those column inches so that more coverage would be on what she said, not how she looked. Ironically, Elizabeth Dole, whose husband ran against Mrs. Clinton's husband in 1996 for the presidency, she ran for United States Senate in North Carolina the same year and did the same exact thing. Stopped changing the hair color, made sure that there wasn't a lot of coverage of do the shoes and the hair match the bag. I think there is a double standard for women because people are so focused on the visual image. And women are defensive. I'll just share a quick story I heard years ago. It's like if the husband and wife are sitting over dinner and they're having a dinner of, just say, some kind of meat. And if if the man had picked up the meat on the way home, unlikely, and the wife said, where did you get this meat? He would say, Joe's Butcher Shop. If the husband asks the woman, where did you get this meat? She immediately says, why? What's wrong with it? And I think that's a very telling anecdote for the question that Martha has posed.
So, Linda, I've just got you and Kellyanne for another minute here. If you had to put a year on it, having seen what we've seen, what's the year, Celinda?
Well, I think it's probably going to be a Republican woman, ironically, and I think it'll be probably 8 years from now.
No kidding. As soon as that, but a Republican. Why a Republican?
Because I think that the party will counter the gender, and I think in the end, a Republican woman will be the right combination of compassion, but the Republican part will communicate toughness and fiscal conservatism. And I think that's probably what voters are going to be ready for in 8 years.
Kellyanne, that's your party. Will you put a name on that woman in 8 years?
Well, from Celinda's lips to the voters' ears, for sure. I think there's a point to what she's making. It has to be a woman who is seen as being effective on what's considered to be the male issues, someone who is financially sophisticated, has experience in business probably, and yet can be seen the way our three consecutive secretaries of state have been seen now, Madeleine Albright, Condoleezza Rice, and Hillary Clinton, tough on defense and having the proper acumen in militaristic and foreign policy and peace and negotiation efforts. I'm not going to put a name on it the way I don't talk about 2012, because I want it to be a free-for-all, as many women who want to sign up for that position as possible.
Okay. Kellyanne Conway and Celinda Lake, co-authors of What Women Really Want. We're going to come back and ask Ann Kornblut if she'll put her name on it. Kellyanne, Celinda, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Ann Kornblut's new book is Notes from the Cracked Ceiling, and it's terrific. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about women and political power in America with Ann Kornblut, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Her new book is Notes from the Cracked Ceiling, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and What It Would Take for a Woman to Win. That is, win the White House. She followed those campaigns. She saw what she saw, and we all saw the outcome. You can join the conversation this hour when the network news can do it with female anchors. When colleges and law schools are jammed with women, why not the halls of power? And why didn't women come out stronger for Hillary Clinton, for Sarah Palin? Are women tougher on women? Ann Kornblut joins us from Washington. Ann, so many questions, but one, just put us in a context here globally. I mean, where does the United States stand in terms of representation, women office holders as a percentage of office holders? Are we in the top, the middle, the bottom? How do we stack up?
Well, to my great surprise, when I started reporting the book, I found we are very low down the list. Depending on how you calculate it, whether as a percentage of the legislature or in terms of having a head of state, we're in the 70s in some lists.
As in 70 countries with more female representation than ours.
That's precisely right. And countries you wouldn't expect, countries like Rwanda and North Korea, some countries in Europe that have percentages, Europe and elsewhere, that have quotas that are required, but nonetheless have more women than we do in power. In the United States, we've never gotten over 20% of Congress, either House of Congress, being women. And I think it's easy to forget that sometimes because we have had such visible women, namely Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, Hillary Clinton running. We also haven't had women governors of some very big states. I would say to what Kellyanne said before the break about there being a woman in the future, it's hard to imagine somebody as soon as 2008 because it's hard to imagine who that person would be. I think we all think that perhaps Sarah Palin will run. Sorry, I meant 2012. Perhaps Sarah Palin will run in 2012, somebody else by 2016. But so far, that short list is extremely short of the women, the actual women who might run, as opposed to theoretically, would we elect one?
And what about the trend in state houses, in governor's mansions, in Congress? You say that people talked about the Year of the Women back in the early 90s, but that that movement may have stalled out.
There's no question that there were greater numbers by leaps and bounds, especially 1992. But since then, since the Year of the Woman, there has never been a tripling of the numbers of women in the Senate, which means that there's been this kind of leveling off, perhaps an addition here and there, one a year perhaps. But in some places, I would use South Carolina as an example, the legislature actually now has no women at all. So they went from having some women to having no women. Other states, New Hampshire is one, have seen an increase in women in the state house.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could say, well, that's the state house in one place. But what's important about that is that's the feeder for some of these higher offices where women start to run. Let's not forget, of course, that Obama was a state senator before mm-hmm. he ran for Congress and then Senate and became president. So those lower levels do actually matter.
Let's hear from our listeners. Nashville, Tennessee, Aaron, you're on the air with Ann Kornblut.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My problem with Hillary was not so much one of how she was covered or anything else. It's more one of history and her political stance and tactics. You know, I was in high school when her husband was in office, and so to me, she's very closely associated with the shift to the right for the Democratic Party. And in some ways, it was that I just could not get over that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I do wish there were more women in politics, because I would gladly support and, you know, even, you know, volunteer in campaigns. But I could not support her because of that history.
So it's the particulars here rather than gender that caught you. And everybody does come with a particular history. And Hillary Clinton's was beyond compare. I mean, it is a very, very unique. And, is, of course, talk about being tied to a husband. Her husband had been president.
Well, it's so interesting to hear what the caller said. I'm just a little bit older. I was in college when mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton was first lady. And I was thinking when I was watching her campaign that if she won, it would have meant that more than half of my lifetime, there would have been a Clinton or a Bush in the Oval Office, and how remarkable that was. And I heard from a lot of people my age that that was the problem. It had nothing to do with gender. So, of course, and I don't, in the book, argue that either she or Sarah Palin lost because they were women, but that that was a complicating factor that not everybody understood how it would play into. I will say, in other countries, and even in the United States, in state houses and in Senate races and in governor's races, a lot of women have come to office through their husbands. This wouldn't have been the first time that it happened, mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. women either filled the seat of their dead husband or run, in the case of Clinton and Liddy Dole, because their husband's name has made them famous. But there did seem to be this yearning, very unmistakable yearning in this last election, for a woman who's gotten there on her own, on her own merits, without a husband and without any baggage. And so that's something I think a future candidate will definitely have to bear in mind.
Some would say, well, look at Sarah Palin. Her husband certainly didn't get her elected governor of Alaska, and her husband didn't put her on the McCain ticket.
And then we heard the opposite reaction of, who is this person and what has she ever done? She came from nowhere. How can she possibly be on the ticket? So I think but that was actually, to her credit initially, a lot of people said that that was a refreshing kind of model. So I would expect that we'd see someone like that. I would say in California, the Meg Whitman example of somebody who made their own money, whose husband is successful nonetheless, but is not the reason that they are successful, is one that a lot of people are looking to as a potential future model as well.
Meg Whitman is former CEO of eBay. Do you see Kellyanne sort of hinting in her direction when she says, and Celinda say, 8 years out, a woman and a Republican president?
Well, possibly, although Meg Whitman right now has an uphill battle just to get the Republican
right.
nomination to
right.
run for governor of California,
right.
and then she has to win the general. So
right.
so when I say that the specific names of women, there are no obvious women at this point who could run and win in 2012.
That sounds like in 2012. Still, it's a huge statement. It's a big country, 300 million people and a lot of successful women in it.
I hope I'm wrong, by the way. I hope I'm surprised. As a reporter, I live to be surprised. And so that may be the case.
Let's go to Phoenix, Arizona. And Eric. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Well, hi, Tom. Yeah, I think the whole issue is rather, it's not a real issue. I think you're tokenizing the gender of our political candidates. I don't think that a political candidate should be chosen on the basis of gender, and that you should simply listen to what they're saying, and if you like what they're saying, if they're a good candidate, vote for them for that reason.
Eric, does that mean you think that the electorate or the political sort of power structure that puts people in position to run is gender blind? Does the electorate, does the pipeline not pay attention?
So the vast majority of people do not vote. I mean, if you look at the number of people who actually voted in the last presidential election, even though it was up, you're still looking at a large percentage of people do not vote. And if you're looking for people who vote simply because, oh, there's a male or female, a black or a white president, then you're looking at a very small minority of voters. You want to go for the issues. And I think a male candidate could represent female issues just as well as a female candidate. And I think that the point is that you should vote for people because of what of their candidacy, not because of their gender.
Yeah, we've got it. And Eric goes to the very base assumption here of basic assumption of, you know, looking at it through gender at all. He's kind of saying, you know, hey, Anne, Tom, you're perpetuating the problem by holding up a gender prism to it.
I guess then built into that is the assumption that only male candidates must be viewed as qualified by the electorate because no woman has ever actually won. I mean, this assumption that women are running on gender and winning, perhaps I could see why it would strike people the wrong way. But the truth is women are 20% of Congress and have never won the White House. So unless it's simply that male candidates are just better, then I think it is actually worth scrutinizing why that is.
I mean, you point out that women tend to have male strategists handling them, and you see that as a potential problem.
I think all campaigns probably need a mix of men and women in them after looking at both the Clinton and Palin campaigns, not necessarily because of the candidates themselves, but because the electorate is both male and female. And so you saw a lot of men telling Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton things to do that didn't necessarily resonate with women. In the case of Clinton, certainly not young women early on. But I think that for both Republicans, Democrats, male candidates, female candidates, we've seen a lot of evidence that it's good to have advisors of both genders.
Hillary Clinton certainly did put on the battle armor. I mean, she developed a lot of her own, no doubt, over her years in the public life. But if Mark Penn advised her to be tough, she certainly was tough. Then there was that sort of misty-eyed moment in New Hampshire. Do you, in retrospect, see that as having helped her by humanizing or something or hurt her?
The conventional wisdom, of course, is that that moment in New Hampshire where she choked up, she didn't actually cry, she choked up, did help her. I believe that only to a point. I think it helped her in that, yes, it humanized her. But if you go back and, as I do in the book, retrace what actually happened that weekend in New Hampshire, she was also dismissed a little bit by Obama during their debate where he said, you're likable enough, which got the hackles up of some women in New Hampshire. And then after she teared up or she choked up, some of the commentary on television was, well, it's over. This is her Ed Muskie moment. So I'm not sure that what we saw in response to that was people feeling empathy toward her as much as rallying to her defense, seeing her really for the first time as a woman instead of just a Clinton.
Let's go to Jack in Waltham, Massachusetts. Jack, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. Since it does seem at this point that barring some unforeseen circumstance like a family or health issue that Sarah Palin will, there's a good probability, I think, will get the nomination for the Republicans. And the fact that in the past people like Aunt Merkel of Germany and Thatcher of England, conservative women tend to, you know, win for the reasons you discussed before because they're, you know, strong on defense. I'm wondering, and I realize that your guests may deny this, but I'm wondering whether this all of a sudden undermining or questioning the possibility of a woman winning is really because they fear, the mainstream media fears that it will be Sarah Palin. And it will be in 2012, and precisely because of that, the author is coming out with books questioning whether it can be done. In other words, all of a sudden, when it looks like it's going to be Palin, they think it can't be done. But when it was Clinton, it was okay.
And have you got a grand scheme behind your book? And what about the observation?
It's a fair question. I'd never even thought of that. But I can assure you there is no conspiracy theory here. I, as a reporter, as a political reporter, would love nothing more than to see Sarah Palin run a serious campaign and get traction so that we could cover it. I think at this point there's no assurance that she's going to run. I know she has a lot of supporters who want her to. What we've seen, what we saw out of the exit polling in 2008 was that there were problems in her candidacy, and there are problems even within the Republican Party with her candidacy. But I have said from the beginning, and if you read the book, I think you'll believe me, that she is not someone who should be discounted and that it would be a mistake to do so, that she has a very loyal base. And if there's any woman, there's only one name of a woman who might really run in 2012, and it's Sarah Palin.
What about Jack's judgment that it's likely that she'll emerge as the GOP candidate nominee? It's a long way off, but what's your gut tell you about his assessment?
Just as anybody who predicted that Hillary Clinton would be the Democratic nominee 2 years out and was wrong, I am not going to make that prediction now. I think we learned our lesson last time about doing that.
We've heard some names on the GOP side there. I mean, starting with Sarah Palin, but also Meg Whitman, Carly Fiorina came up, the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard. What about in the Democratic pipeline, the word you've put out here, Anne?
taking it as an assumption that no one's going to challenge Obama in a Democratic primary in 2012, I think we'd then be looking to 2016. Mm-hmm. And some of the people I spoke to for the book included Secretary Janet Napolitano, who's been in the news recently yes. because of the recent terror attack. A couple of other senators, Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota, Senator Claire McCaskill from Missouri. They're two women who are relatively new to the Senate, have made a name for themselves. In Florida, the woman who's running for governor, Alex Sink, is intriguing to a lot of people and has been mentioned as somebody who's charismatic, who might very well be able to run for higher office if she were to win the Florida governorship. And then there are some other people, Kirsten Gillibrand in New York, who filled Hillary Clinton's seat in the Senate, is another. Some House members, although it's very hard to go from the House to the Senate. And then back on the Republican side, there is a loyal following of Condoleezza Rice, people who still want her to run. But I interviewed her for the book, and mm-hmm. it didn't seem like that was in the immediate cards.
Because of gender, problems or, you know, the difficulty gender-wise or something else?
She's never run for elected office in the first place. So to go from zero to running for president could be a challenge. But when I talked to her, she seemed keenly aware of the challenges of gender, and in fact told me that she thought we'd, as a country, crossed the threshold on race quite some time ago, but had not gotten there on gender, and that was based on her many years in the public eye. So she seemed to be wary, thanks to her own experiences.
Let me get one more call. Helen in Worcester, Massachusetts. Helen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My thought is that a lot of this has also to do with the fractionalization of feminism altogether. You have people who are concerned about bumping their head against the glass ceiling, but on the other hand, for them to do it, they have to have child care workers and house cleaners, and those are largely females who aren't in that same group. On top of that, you have the older feminists, and I talk with a lot of young women who really don't feel that it matters anymore, that they're already taken care of, that this isn't an issue for them. So you have this real fractionalization around the concept of feminism that seems to be part of this.
Helen, it's a great point, and our time is short. Thank you. And, if you've got a generation for whom, as Helen said, and it's nearly your words, it isn't an issue, do you think that makes the election of a female president more or less likely?
I think it just means that a woman candidate is going to have to speak in the language that young women can understand, women of my generation can understand, which is to talk about the work-life balance as opposed to talking in some kind of 1960s feminist terms that are no longer relevant, no longer part of the national discourse. I think Helen's absolutely right that that's one of the things, and that's one of the challenges that a younger female candidate is going to have to address.
Well, there we are. Lifetimes of many different ages waiting for us to see whether or not the prediction comes true in our lifetime. That's a lot of different numbers out there. And you've given us some tremendous insights here on what's gone on and what may go on down the road. The new book is Notes from the Cracked Ceiling, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and What It Would Take for a Woman to Win. Ann Kornblut is White House correspondent for The Washington Post. It's great to have you. Terrific work. Thank you very much, Ann.
Thanks so much for having me.
On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gal Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.